Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. Great to have your company. Morning, Amy. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Tiger. How are you this morning?
Yep, very good, very good. Now, again, we have a guest in Western Australia from Perth who's not available until about 9.30 here, before 9.30. Professor Michael Chandler.
Yeah, and he's a First Nations, he's a Canadian academic who's been heavily involved in researching youth suicide rates in First Nations communities over in Canada. And a lot of Aboriginal groups over here are sort of looking at his research and how it could potentially be applicable in our own country, because obviously we have such high suicide rates. And we were talking last week to Professor Pat Dudgeon on World Suicide Prevention Day, and she actually mentioned him as well. So it was, right. It was, you know, quite fortunate we were able to get him on the program while he was in Australia. And I'm sure he'll have some interesting things to say. It'll be also interesting to see how different it is in Canada, because obviously they have a greater degree of autonomy and self-determination.
And some stats and figures or programs in relation to suicides. I mean, I don't think we have a lot here in this country.
No one's really talking about it, we're talking about it,
yes,
but what's actually being done isn't.
That's right.
Like absolutely everything else in Aboriginal affairs, blackfellas are talking about it, but what's actually happening on a political level?
Yes, that's right. So that'll be good. Looking forward to talking to Michael Chandler. Abbott got a couple of regrets. Well, he probably have a heap of regrets, but the ones that he wants to sort of put out to the public.
Well, yesterday it took him a very long time to speak to the media and announce his resignation, formally announce his resignation, didn't he? Mm. Took him until about 12:30 yesterday, I think, where he actually addressed the media. And he gave a speech. I don't know if you saw the speech, Tiger. It didn't really make much sense, the time it took, given the content of the speech. There wasn't really much to it, but his only sort of acknowledgement of Aboriginal Affairs and being Prime Minister of Aboriginal Affairs was when he talked about his regrets, which is very apt. But his regrets were that there's much that I still wanted to do, including constitutional reform of Indigenous people, and also he wanted to work more to tackle the challenges of ICE and domestic violence.
ICE and domestic violence.
What has he done?
I think that's probably the first time he's mentioned the word ICE, the term ICE.
Yeah, well, I mean, you don't hear a lot about it coming
not
from
this level.
Abbott.
No, not at that level.
And also domestic violence. I mean, Rosie Batty was Australian of the Year this year. But other than that, the Minister for Women, he failed women, didn't he? He didn't exactly give a lot of voice. And actually, when I was watching a lot of the media coverage and the cameras around the place during the leadership spill, all the cabinet, I mean, it's just so stark to see only one woman sitting amongst a sea of white men, you know, Julie Bishop amongst all these old white men. It really makes you think, doesn't it?
It certainly does make you think. And that's where part of the real problem lies. White, privileged, elderly males making decisions for all of us, women, asylum seekers, men, children, the lot. Doesn't work real well. And now that brings to mind, I suppose, a comment on Twitter or Facebook or something. One person's comment was, well, they're Tiger and Karen Durand and people, they're talking about the issues of Aboriginal affairs, but why don't they come up with some solutions?
I think that's such a cop-out when people talk about, you know, when you're talking about criticism and holding those in power to account in the media, and immediately your detractors automatically start talking about solutions. But it's about deflecting the criticism. Obviously, we're not going to – it's such a complicated policy area. We're not going to come up with solutions. But we talk about solutions every single day, don't
we? We do. And if they're not on the terms of the dominant culture, dominant society, privileged, well, not so much privileged, but dominant culture, non-Indigenous mainstream people, if it's not on their terms or to their liking, they'll poo-poo it and what have you. I mean, yesterday was a good example, June Oscar.
Yep.
There's a fine example of solutions in how a community took some steps and made decisions and consulted in community and got the agreement. And it wasn't a consensus situation either. There was dissenters or people that didn't agree with the changes in the alcohol laws and things, how they, what they should be serving and what have you. But there's a fine example of a community.
Yep. A strong control. Aboriginal woman too. It was led very much so by the women in that community.
Yep. So when this bloke, again, a male, I think it was, makes these criticisms, and that's all well and good. But when you hear the solutions, take something on board, open your ears, have a bit of a listen and and acknowledge that first up we've got to identify and discuss and put it out there. I mean, people like this bloke probably may not know a lot of the issues and stuff, but...
It's exactly the same as the ICE Summit we were at last Friday. I mean, it was organised by the Queensland Aboriginal Islander Health Council, but it brought together a lot of people who are actually working actively within their communities to tackle ICE before it becomes an epidemic. Now, if that's not talking about solutions, I don't know what is.
So, again, it comes back to, well, you've got to do it on their terms, otherwise...
It's very much white terms.
Yes, very much white terms. So thanks for your comment. It's good to know that you're hearing the programming and the discussions and the views and topics and things, but be a little more open-minded and see what you come up with. But, you know, we appreciate the commentary, the feedback.
Yeah, definitely. Mm. when we were talking about Tony Abbott yesterday, this idea that he regrets and he wanted to do more on constitutional reform, what do you think of that, Tiger, when you hear that, considering how he dragged his feet on it for so long?
Yeah. Nice time to regret it. Now, he must have thought he was in for two or three terms, this bloke.
Or at least one term. He wouldn't get shafted.
Yeah, a complete term, yeah.
But a lot of people were talking about he was a couple of days short of getting his prime ministerial pension, which would have been about, I think, $400,000 a year. He actually still gets a really good parliamentary pension because he's been in parliament for 21 years. Parts of that were as minister, health minister in the Howard government. He was opposition leader for a while. He was prime minister. So I was reading in the Canberra Times yesterday, he still gets about $300,000 a year as his pension.
But he misses out on a higher pension.
Yeah, he just misses out on about, I think it was $600,000 or something ridiculous that prime ministers get when they leave office. But they also get an office, they get a staff, they got money for staff.
And travel and all sorts of things.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if this is still the case, but I'm pretty sure they used to get business class or first class travel, didn't they?
Yeah, Gold Pass, rail or what have you, you know. Yeah.
I once saw Bob Hawke on the plane in Vanuatu.
Did you?
And we were waiting in Port Vila Airport and he was waiting there and my dad, no one else knew who he was except my dad. And he said to one of our friends who was there, that's the former Prime Minister of Australia. Then suddenly this fellow goes real loud, Prime Minister Blow Vanuatu, Prime Minister Blow Australia, Prime Minister Blow Australia, real loud, just as he's walking past.
Yeah.
But he was in business class, of course, with his new wife who wrote his biography.
Yep.
Yeah, so Abbott won't be worried. Abbott won't be on welfare. Still the age of entitlement for him.
Yeah, for sure. But isn't it sad, poor bugger, he misses out by 3 days on a higher rate, a higher pension. Too bad. Sorry,
poor Tony, Abbott, poor Tony. Abbott, and his poor daughters, poor, you know, what's Frances going to do?
That's right, yes.
Frances Abbott will have to get a job now.
I just think it's outrageous that these people can be given such a, especially after a poor performance in Parliament, like Abbott in his Prime Minister's role. I think it was a very poor performance. But that these people can be given such a superannuant package or entitlements with these pensions and stuff after serving so many years. I just think it's outrageous. And there's a big drain on the taxpayers' dollar. That count up the number of former prime ministers we have, but it also flows on to premiers and politicians that have been in for long terms and stuff. They all get a pretty good sort of a package. I mean, there's a big lot of taxpayers' dollars going down there.
Yeah, it makes you realise how far removed they are from the average Australian, isn't it?
Yes.
It's still very much the elite, and Abbott, I guess he was sort of seen as sort of more of a populist, more of a man of the people, sort of, not really, but, you know, compared to someone like Malcolm Turnbull, who's obviously rich before he entered Parliament.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's not really. I mean, we've got to remember these politicians. They're in their own little world. They're in their own little bubble. That's why we get the policies that we get.
That's why we get them. That's right. I do see in the papers today that he's taking solace in his faith. Did he ever think about solace in his faith for the asylum seekers and those deaths that have just recently occurred?
Well, it's very un-Christian, isn't it?
Boat people. I mean, what a contradiction. But it seems typical of a lot of those Christians, where it's quite contradictory, their faith, their beliefs, and then how they actually live their lives. And I would make a claim that Abbott couldn't claim to be an honourable person with his behaviour and way that he's...
Actually, Chris Graham, who's a regular guest yesterday, compared him to Ted Bundy, who's the notorious serial killer in America. And I think it caused a bit of a stir because Ted Bundy was obviously just a psychopath. Mm. I think he was actually executed for killing about 30 women. But the point Chris was making was that, okay, Ted Bundy did horrible things. You're not denying that. But Abbott ultimately hurt a lot more people when you think about it. When you think about his policies towards asylum seekers and stop the boats and how inhumane it was locking up people and children in Manus and Nauru and all the human rights abuses that go on in Nauru particularly. I mean, it's absolutely shocking. And to use, you know, the most vulnerable people in the world, really, as election...
Yeah, exactly.
As political... playthings, you know.
Yeah.
But what Chris was saying, that at least Ted Bundy showed remorse, because before he was executed, he said, yeah, I'm sorry for what I'd done. It was the wrong thing, which is weird for a serial killer, I think. But he was making the comparison that Abbott didn't even do that. He talked about his achievements and very little about his regrets, very little about stopping the boats. In fact, he said he had stopped the boats.
Yes, stopped the boats.
So there's no accountability when they leave office, is there? There's no remorse. You just basically leave all this destruction and these broken lives in your wake, and you can just go on with your parliamentary pension and live your life.
And we're supposed
to feel sorry for you? Like Chris Yeoman, for example, on the ABC was going on about he's a good person, you know. We forget that politicians are humans as well. Well, you know, kids behind us razor wire in Nauru are people as well.
Yes.
What about them?
Exactly. They don't think of them. Yeah, yeah. Yes. No, it's a good point you make. Children behind razor wire. And the way that this Abbott-led government and now Turnbull, who says that he's not going to make any changes to any of the policies.
Turnbull's not going to change. He's going to be pulled to the right. He's not Malcolm in the middle. He's going to be continually pulled towards the conservative side, isn't he? Because he's not going to make the mistakes he made on climate change when he was negotiating an ETS. He's never going to do anything concrete on that, even if he wants to.
Yes. That's right. He's one man in the party, and the party will dictate the terms and policies and stuff, and he has to abide by them, I imagine.
His job is just to get elected and
right.
beat Labor.
Yes.
And that, I don't think that's going to be hard to do. They're saying that now that Turnbull is a leader, I think Crikey was talking about the numbers, the polling in Canning, which we're waiting. There's a by-election on Saturday. It shows that already there's a sort of a swing to the Liberal member there now that Malcolm Turnbull's leader. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in Canning. But, yeah, it looks like we may have another Liberal government if we look at the results from Canning on the weekend, if they come through in favour of Liberals. So it's very disturbing.
Well, you know, you've got to worry if Shorten was the new Prime Minister. I mean, my God, I think that's more
Shorten's
of a worry.
Shorten has so much blood on his hands, doesn't he?
Yep. Yes, he does. Let's take a break for a song. Andy Albert's with Wisdom Man. And we'll be calling up our guest in a little while. Welcome back. Trying to get our guest in Perth, and our phone system's not... we've got some gremlins. We'll get there.
Yeah, it's a bit of a shame. Hopefully we can definitely get Professor Chandler on, because he's a really important guest, so it's a bit of a shame our phone lines have gone down.
Yeah. No, we've got our guys here are working on it, so...
Yeah, we've got some deadly people here at the radio station.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, so...
We've got a caller on the line. Let's see who we got, Amy. Welcome to Let's Talk. Who we got? Hello. Welcome to Let's Talk. Got somebody there? No, not phone system. It's
I think it's the phone system, unfortunately. So if you're trying to ring in, we're having a bit of trouble this morning. So Tiger and I will keep talking about Tony Abbott. There's always a lot to talk about.
One thing I see, there's a press release saying that the Victorian government has agreed to permanently fly the First Nations flag at Parliament House.
Well, that's a good thing. I mean, Queensland's been doing it for a while, haven't they? I think since 2006 or 2007, I think it was.
Yeah, I'm not too sure.
Townsville MP up there. Much. Yeah, I think the state Townsville MP, who wasn't that bad actually at the time. I can't remember what his name.
Reynolds?
It wasn't the Gammon one.
The speaker.
Yeah.
He was a good guy.
He was a good guy, yeah. And he was the one who started it out Queensland and raced it first, I'm pretty sure, because I remember reporting on it at the time. But the Greens down in Victoria, they ran into a bit of trouble. They got a state MP for Melbourne there. The only Greens lower house MP or something like that. But she actually ran into a bit of trouble because she was campaigning for the Aboriginal flag to be out the front of Parliament House, but she was campaigning with the Greens emblem down the bottom. So she caused a bit of a furore because she was obviously defacing the Aboriginal flag with the Greens symbol. So even Greenies, Aboriginal Greenies, were a bit annoyed at that. But, I mean, good for Victoria to finally put their Aboriginal flag out the front of Parliament House. It's amazing that it took them so long.
Yes. That took them so long. The Premier, Daniel Andrews, said it was a move of respect. He said, and I quote, "Aboriginal people are the traditional owners of this country. It's only right that we acknowledge their continued connection as the custodians of this land. Flying of the flag is a clear statement of Aboriginal culture and identity. The oldest living culture in the world continues as ever, strong, resilient and proud."
Well, that's all right. Hopefully they put their money where their mouth is. They
Western
talk the
Australia,
talk.
They had their, they've amended, I think, the preamble to their constitution.
Yeah. Well, what will that do?
Exactly. What will it do? I mean, Queensland did it. I think
New South Wales has done it.
New South Wales, Victoria, and now Western Australia. So, Amy, how does that do anything for the argument for constitutional reform, when the state governments, a number of state governments in this country, they've done it? But are there any life-changing situations that's taken place? Is it going to have any real effect on any of our real issues, our issues and
challenges? Well, I sort of nothing. I think you would agree, nothing too. And I think I saw a lot of press around it in Western Australia, you know, sort of positive press that the state government has passed this preamble, but they're actually actively trying to wind back culture and heritage in WA. Like, they're actually trying to weaken the already weak Heritage Act over there in order to make way for development. And you won't hear as much about that, will you?
No, not
about
at all.
The WA government and their plans in that regard.
And they still got their eye on the ball as far as closing down communities.
They do.
As well.
In fact, I think they were starting consultations, and I just said consultations in air quotes because I don't know if I believe they're truly ready to consult or want to consult, but they're talking it to a few communities. So it's still on the agenda, I think. It's just gone a bit underground.
Mm. Yes. It's just
but let's not forget the Abbott government's role in this too, in the Barnett government's plans to close down communities, because they basically offloaded all that funding for remote municipal and infrastructural services back to the state. It's always been a Commonwealth responsibility. So they've given it to, basically said, we'll give you $90 million and you do it to the states. I mean, you can't trust the WA government to deliver proper infrastructure. The federal government can't even do it.
That's right.
They've been unwilling to do it. And this is the right of every citizen. So both the Liberals in Canberra and the Liberals over in WA are screwed up in that regard, I think.
Yes, I think you're right.
And we're still having trouble with our phone system, are we?
Yep. We're unable to get our guests at this stage. But insofar as where things are at with constitutional reform, I mean, been a bit quiet on that front?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it'll be interesting to see what Turnbull does, but I don't think he's going to do a lot. It's not going to be his main priority. But again, I mean, we still think it's a white thing, don't we?
It is a white thing. I suppose it brings back to, for the discussion, Amy, is all right, well, what do we do in the meantime? We're watching governments play silly buggers with flying the flag at Parliament House in Victoria, amending the Western Australian Constitution. We're watching them play silly buggers. It's not doing anything. It's probably great symbolically, but symbolism does not stop the high rate of incarceration. Symbolism does not stop the high suicide rates. Symbolism doesn't improve health and housing and what have you. Symbolism doesn't deal with the issues of alcohol and smokes, cigarettes and ice. You know, symbolism doesn't deal with this.
It does
so
nothing.
What do we do as First Nations people? We have to be organising on the ground. We have to be mobilising our mob, I believe.
Oh, I definitely agree. Definitely agree. I think
we've got here. Welcome to Let's Talk. Who have we got?
Hello. Yeah,
we've got a... Oh, good day. Welcome to the program. How are you? Hello?
Yes, hi. This is Michael Chandler here. I'm being called on two phones at once.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us, Professor Chandler. We've had a lot of problems with our phone lines this morning, so I'm glad we're able to get you on because we were trying really hard to get you on. But welcome to the program.
John, I'm being talked to on the other ear. I'm sorry. Hold on for a minute.
All right. So we have our guest, the Canadian academic, Professor Michael Chandler. We'll get a few minutes with him today. And maybe we'll get some more time with him before he leaves the country. Now, there's a big SNAIC conference in Perth.
Yes.
SNAIC is the Secretariat for the National Aboriginal and Islander Childcare.
Torres Strait Childcare, yeah.
Yeah, childcare.
So they do an annual conference every year, and I think they've got about 1,000 people over in Perth at the moment and a lot of great keynote speakers. Professor Chandler's one of them. Also June Oscar. The professor we had on last week, Pat Dudgeon, she's talking. So it's a really important issue because obviously our children are being taken away at ever-increasing rates, aren't they, Tiger?
Oh, my goodness me. It's just it's alarming. It's just too high numbers. And again, we have an issue with in our own community, Amy. I think we have an issue with a lot of our own mob unable to be carers, trying to find alternatives. There's got government policy and stuff. But let's see if Michael's still with us. Michael, you're still with us?
Yes, I am.
Very good, very good. We've got another... yep, that's good. Well, Michael, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Well, it's quite early here.
Yes, it is a little early.
You must be a bit jet-lagged as well, I can imagine, coming all the way from Canada.
Yeah, it's 28 hours door-to-door. Yeah.
Oh, lovely.
Can we just ask you, first of all, your background and your dealings with First Nations communities in Canada?
Yes. I was trained originally as a developmental psychologist. And over time, grew interested in the way in which context in general shapes the way the young kids grow and develop. And that led to an interest in Indigenous affairs. The word Aboriginal doesn't play very well, by the way, in North America.
It doesn't play real well in most of this country too, but some of our mobs still use it.
Yeah.
Yes. So what is the preferred term? Sorry to interrupt you, but what is the preferred term?
It changes at lightning speed, but for the moment it's Indigenous.
Oh, that's interesting.
Individuals.
Okay, because that doesn't stand real well with a lot of our mob too, Indigenous and Aboriginal. So a lot of us have been using the term First Nations. But that's interesting, Indigenous, yeah. Okay, sorry to interrupt you there.
And First Nations, by the way, is the people who refer to themselves as First Nations individuals are one of three Indigenous cultural groups in Canada. There are also Inuit, who we used to think of as Eskimos, and there are Métis people who are, in the first instance, the offspring of French fur traders and Aboriginal women. So that's part of the semantic difficulty here, is trying to find a way that people would like to be referred to.
The other term that comes up here is origines or originals. this foreign language stuff's a real, it's a real...
Well, we're using the colonizers'
issue.
Language, aren't
we? It's still colonizers' language and stuff, yeah. So a lot of our mob, Michael, prefer to identify as their under their tribal banner.
Right.
Their country.
Yes, that's also true in Canada.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me say that over perhaps a span of almost 20 years now, I became interested in the high rates of suicide that characterize Indigenous youth in Canada. And so to try to understand the dramatic differences that separate the suicide rates of ordinary Eurocentric peoples from... Are you still there? I heard a click.
Yes, no, we're with you.
Okay, good. But I'm just making the point that whereas youth suicide is a tragedy wherever it occurs, it's true that it happens, and this is a disputable claim, at least five times more frequently among Indigenous youth. And so there's a puzzle there to be solved. And so a lot of my research efforts have been in the direction of trying to understand this high suicide rate in the Indigenous world. And words like epidemic are commonly thrown about. So the focus of the work that I've done grows out of a long tradition, really it's a philosophic tradition, which understands the whole conception of personhood or the notion of being an individual as requiring two constitutive factors. One is owning your own history. That is, if you're a person who, for example, an amnesic person who's lost contact with their past, is in desperate straits. The other half is that you have to have an investment in your own as yet unrealized future. And it's important to reflect on the fact that when colonizing groups approach the indigens of any place, Australia, parts of North America, but really around the world, two things are commonly done. The indigenous people are seen as childlike, and their belief systems are thought to be mythologic and unrelated to contemporary notions of truth. Their ownership of their past is discounted because it's seen as a kind of a remnant of a childhood fantasy. And similarly, because Indigenous peoples are viewed commonly by colonizers as in many ways childlike, they require, and often this is couched in deeply religious terms, they require a kind of parental control, which really means telling people what to do.
Yeah.
And the result of that is that Indigenous people not only have had their past truncated, but they've had their future essentially erased as something that's within their own control.
It's really interesting, Professor General. I was reading a bit about your research, and you were obviously talking about that different First Nation communities have higher youth suicide rates, and other First Nation or Aboriginal Indigenous communities actually have next to no suicide. Are those communities that have lower rates of suicide able to sort of, when you're talking about not having control over the past and the future, do they have a sense of that, having a control of their future? Is that what you found?
Yeah, you're right on target here. I mean, one of the things we did in the province of British Columbia, where I work, there are more than 200 culturally distinct bands. Bands are like tribes or mobs. So there are 200 distinct groups. And within those groups, there is a radical difference in the youth suicide rate. So it turns out that although talk of Indigenous youth suicide is on everyone's lips. It's also the case that half, that is more than 100 of these 200 bands, have never had a youth suicide.
Wow.
Others have suicide rates hundreds of times the national average. So once you're confronted with that kind of radical difference across the panoply of Indigenous communities, you know, the question that inquiring minds want to know the answer to is what distinguishes those communities with lower absent suicide rates from the suicide rates of other communities that are hundreds of times that of the general population.
And what were those things?
That's a sort of a beginning state of affairs the research I've done attempts to address. And the search has been to find those social determinants that characterize the groups without suicide and put them in contrast with groups that have extremely high suicide rates. And you could look anywhere for answers to the question of why some but not other communities have these high rates. And people have speculated, is it the people who live in the woebegone rural areas, or is it people who have lost contact with their community by moving to urban settings? That's one hypothesis kicking around. Another is that it has to do with financial matters, having what's the income available to people in these different communities. And you could search for discriminators, that is, things that distinguish the low and high suicide rate groups almost anywhere. But our search has been to try to find those things that communities can do which work to rehabilitate their past and to help them gain civic control of their future.
It's really interesting. Sorry, Professor Chandler, to break in, but I was just wondering if there's a comparison you can make to Australia, because even though Canada's obviously got this horrific history, it seems that a lot of the time we're a lot worse, and the policy direction we're actually going in is to go towards more telling Aboriginal people what to do. For example, we have compulsory income management, which is basically controlling a person's income, and we're looking at those sort of solutions, or governments are looking at those sort of solutions. Are there key differences in the way Australia and Canada is viewing this problem? Because I think Australia really does have those world-beating suicide rates.
Well, I think, I mean, there are not only differences between Canada and Australia, but within Canada itself, these communities that are so different in having no suicides versus many are different within the range of possibilities within Canada itself. So there are differences, and it's, I think, important to keep those differences squarely in mind. But at the same time, there are attributes of Indigenous peoples, largely wherever you find them. So I described a few moments ago the fact that to be a coherent individual, you have to own your past and control your future. But the same is true for whole cultures. Mm. So a community of people or a collection of people which had no common history and no common ambitions would just be a mob of people. Kind of a random collection of who stepped off the bus. So it's essential that for a cultural group to rehabilitate itself, whether that group is in Canada or in Australia or somewhere else, that undertakings are made to help restore a connection to a traditional past, one that's been cut off by colonial practices, and at the same time to allow them to have some control or increasing control of their own future. Now, there are a lot of, I think, well-meaning people in politics and managerial roles in general who are have a good heart somehow, but they believe that what needs to happen with indigenous groups is they need to be guided and cared for. And so, again, there's this infantilization that is treating indigenous people like they were small children because they can't, in this view, be trusted to take care of themselves. So what we've done is try to find markers that show the extent to which a particular community or mob is taking active steps to restore its traditional past, things like trying to preserve its languages or culture or storytelling or dance, forms of government, forms of judiciary processes, like how do you deal with offenders. There are communities that are deeply involved in trying to rehabilitate the past in some of the ways that I've just described, even building a structure for the preservation of culture. A communal meeting place is an attempt to restore a traditional past. And then there are other things that a community could do, and some do, which is try to achieve some measure of self-government or to control the curricula of the children of these indigenous groups, or influence health and welfare delivery. And so there are attempts to reach into the future and change the way that the goal of these communities, which is to control its own future, can be met. So what we've done is simply tally up how many of those social determinant factors characterize each and every band in the province of British Columbia. And when you do that, you find that there are about eight of these factors, these predictor variables. And in every community that has all of these factors, there are no suicides.
Wow.
And there is a number of communities that have all of those factors.
Right. There are, in fact, it turns out that you don't have to have all six or eight of them. If you have three or four, that gets you in the playing field.
Hmm. What are the factors? Can you give us a brief rundown of what they are?
So there are.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, three or four minutes left. That's why Amy's asking for a brief outline or description of these factors.
Okay, so there are things that are backward referring, that is reaching into the past, like preserving languages, preserving traditional rituals, creating facilities for the preservation of culture, and some sense of entitlement or ownership of traditional lands. And looking more in a more forward way, there are things like controlling or exercising control over the curriculum, health delivery, social welfare delivery, having indigenous title to traditional lands, things of that sort. So it turns out that you can essentially assign each band a score, and the ones that have more rather than less of these factors have fewer suicides, all the way toward, if you have most of them, you have no suicides. And I guess the thing I would want to say in kind of a wrap-up is there is a very strong implication here about what we should do in the future. And you know, everyone interested in suicide prevention is struggling for some model, some set of guidelines to direct how they involve themselves in this problem. And I think what you learn when you know that in a chunk of geography like British Columbia, where there are 200 bands and half of them have no suicides, then those communities obviously have some indigenous knowledge about how to raise children and make a community in which people are safe. So the idea of parachuting solution strategies in from Canberra, kind of top-down approaches, don't seem to work. They're resented and often undermined, and they're probably poorly thought out from the start.
Yeah.
Well, it's encouraging to hear that you mentioned some 200 bands of Indigenous people there, and probably close to half of them don't have the same experience with suicide. Some of them don't have any suicide. So at least you've got a good benchmark to work from, or somebody to go to and look and see what the differences are.
Exactly.
And we certainly, like you say, the top-down approach that we're copying all the time.
Well, we saw it in the intervention. The anti-intervention led to a quadrupling in self-harm and suicide rates in the Northern Territory. So it's exactly what Professor Chandler was saying, I think.
We're going to have to try to contact you again and get you back on for a full discussion here, because this is very interesting. We've now run out of time. We've got the news, our news coming up. We appreciate your time with us, and apologies for the late start with you. We had a big problem with our phone system. So, Professor Michael Chandler,
you're in what city? I'm sorry,
we're in Brisbane, Queensland.
Okay, I'm coming to Brisbane.
Oh, good. Great! We'll get you
on the line. We'll talk to you. Stay there for a minute.
Yes.
You make sure you join us tomorrow on your local First Nations station for your Let's Talk.